Hello! Welcome to this edition of the Bearcats Blogcast. My name is Scott, joined by Chris Baines and Matt Oper. How's it going today, Chris?
It's going great, coming off of a nice little bye week with, you know, despite UC being off, it's a pretty damn entertaining Saturday. Matt, how did you spend your bye week?
I spent how I spend most of my Saturdays working because I chose to be in retail because I'm really smart.
So you missed Chaos Saturday? That's too bad.
I mean, I caught the back half of Chaos Saturday.
Yeah.
So, you know, got to see, you know, Michigan State somehow do the thing that Michigan State always does. I don't know.
Yeah, that was weird. To be honest, that's kind of how I spent mine. Family stuff during the day, all those obligations, pumpkin patches, crap like that. And then, like, the UCF-Memphis game and then the Georgia-LSU game on was all Chris. So I got to partake in that, the excellent back half. The noon games were actually kind of assy anyway, so I'm okay with that.
Yeah, they very much more. But it was still college football all day.
Yeah.
And I didn't have to work or and I don't have kids to take me to pumpkin patches. So I got to enjoy it all.
Shut the hell up, Scott. Okay. Going into Temple, what do you guys have?
I mean, this is going to be the game that really... UC got to 6-0. We still really don't know how good this team is going to... Like, really is. The numbers are positive. All the indications are this is a very good team. But really, no. Because the best teams they played, according to S&P, is probably Miami of Ohio. I think they're like mid-60s right now, which is a shocking turn of events because they were terrible. But yeah, that on the numbers, that's the best team UC has played yet. Temple's another level up. So we're going to find out a lot about this team. And that's why this game is going to be is so interesting, and it's going to kind of serve as a turning point of the season or a focal point of the season because it will dictate how this team is viewed, how this game goes, you know, whether or not they're actually a true contender for the conference or whether or not, you know, they took advantage of a light schedule to start and got out to, you know, a 6-0 record, but maybe they're really not that good. We'll find out a lot more come about 4 o'clock on Saturday.
Yeah, Temple's a bit of an odd team. I mean, they've kind of they've won games that they've been fairly heavily favored in by comfortable margins. I mean, Maryland aside, their defense is elite level. They rank 15th in S&P Plus defense, which is very much Temple like, and their offense is a bottom quarter of college football, which is also very Temple-like, but they've proven they've been able to put up points on the board in recent weeks. I mean, 49 against East Carolina is super surprising. Navy 24 against them isn't super surprising, but they put up 35 against a very good Boston College defense 3 weeks ago. I agree, Matt. This is going to be a definite test on both sides of the ball. It's going to be one of the biggest tests they're going to face. The offense is going to face and has faced all season.
Yeah, definitely. Especially with Temple getting back in their like Temple groove where they just don't lose conference games. Like, we kind of saw this from them last year where they got off to a really rough start. They couldn't find a quarterback. They went back and forth and, like, ended up on New Tile. And, like, then this season, it's almost the opposite, where, like, New Tile started. Then they switched him out for Anthony Russo, who's been, like, pretty competent, and he's starting to get a lot better. He's got, like, 1,100 yards. He just put up 300 yards on Navy. And they kind of, like, have, like, a high-powered offense, like, with some of their big plays, at least lately. After getting off to a really terrible start. And they have a great running back in Reichwell Armstead. So, like, this is really a tough challenge. I think for the defense, especially since, like, you know, Temple's just going to try to run it and grind you and then hit those big pass plays.
Yeah, and the Rock Armstead health situation is really something to pay attention to. He did not play in the Navy game. He is listed as questionable for this game. If he is not in there, their offense looks completely different. They have a backup running back who's okay, but he is not the threat that Armstead is to take the distance on any carry. And if he's not in there, it kind of changes the identity of this team. Like right now, Temple seems to be stuck between, like, it's a changing of the guard on offense, because at times they look like the same old Temple that we've known for the last few years. Dominant defense, really good special teams, and then they have an offensive line and a running back and nothing else. They still have that really good offensive line. If Armstead's healthy, the running back is taken care of. But they're also, the difference between this Temple team in terms of how they look on the field versus previous Temple teams on offense, they have threats on the outside. They have some big weapons out there that they can throw to at any time. Isaiah Wright's really good. Brandon Mack's a huge receiver at 6'5", almost 220 pounds. Ventrell Bryant has been their kind of third down, money down receiver. He gets the majority of their targets. He catches pretty much everything in sight. They got a really good, really big physical tight end who's only a sophomore and who's good now, but is getting better. Like, they have weapons on the perimeter that they haven't had in previous years. You know, like, if P.J. Walker had two of these receivers, Temple would have won the conference multiple times. So they're trying to take advantage of those, but they're still really focused on the running game. And Russo's a really interesting quarterback because all he does, like, he just takes shots. That's all he does. Like, he will put the ball into coverage. He makes contested throws. He puts the ball up for grabs, and that's something that UC has to be able to take advantage of on the road, because, I mean, like, his TD-INT ratio at this point is 6 touchdowns, 7 interceptions, and he's only completing about 55% of his pass. So it's very much boom or bust for their passing game. If UC can force them into passing situations, I will feel really good about this game, just because I trust the secondary a lot.
I was, the one thing that does scare me about, like, Russo is, like, the last 2 weeks, like, they played East Carolina and Navy, granted, like, not the best defenses, but he's gone 44-56, like, for 5 touchdowns, 2 picks. See, like, he lit up East Carolina, like, in their big win. And then, like, he was 23-31 against Navy and threw, like, a long touchdown pass to win that game. It's like, it seems like he's, at least against the bad defenses, he's played really well. Like, against Boston College, he wasn't great. He threw 2 picks. Against Tulsa, he threw 2 picks and was 7-20. It's like, if, like, he's coming on, like, strong, like, they're completely different offense, like, to your point, Matt. And if he, like, has a rocky game, I think this really opens up the door for, like, a nice win for UC, or at least a very low-scoring game. Because, like, Temple's defense doesn't give up big plays. And, like, that's been one of the big things for the Bearcat offense, is hitting some of those big plays. So it's going to be really interesting.
Yeah, and Scott, kind of like building off of that, you know, Armstead is definitely their workhorse in that offense. But he didn't play against Navy, and he didn't, you know, he had one of his worst games of the season against East Carolina. He ran for, you know, 91 yards, but one of the lowest averages of the season. And, you know, despite all of that, Russo still had an excellent game. I mean, so it's not like the offense was leaning on Armstead and then Russo was able to build off of that and put up big numbers. Russo was doing that in spite of Armstead, which kind of also gives me a bit of a concern that you were expressing earlier.
Yeah, and like, he was phenomenal in those last two games. I'm not discounting that at all. But those are pretty bad defenses, especially Navy. Navy is, if it wasn't for UConn, Navy would be the worst defense in the conference. So that's saying something. That's not a compliment. The more relevant comparison, though, I think, is how he performed against Boston College, where he just didn't look quite right the entire game. He wasn't really consistent. He put a lot of passes up for grabs against a defense that is you know, similar in terms of its profile, in terms of how its defensive line looks, in terms of how its secondary looks to what UC has. So his performance in that game gives me a little bit of confidence going into this one. Now, the difference there is it was at Boston College. This game is a home game for Temple. And young players are always completely different home and away.
Yeah, and no one's saying that, like, I mean, putting a number against East Carolina Navy is, you know, you got to put a giant asterisk against that. It's still, like, kind of, like, to match your original point, you know, they do have a passing game this year. Like, this isn't like, you know, P.J. Walker where he'll run around, scramble, and maybe find someone downfield who actually can catch a ball every now and then. Like, they have an actual established passing offense to complement an always excellent running game. And it's just, you know, it's one of those situations where if UC's not careful, they can give up touchdowns and yards in bunches, if unlike other years against Temple.
Yeah, I mean, that, like, we're circling around the same point. This is a much right. better Temple passing game. It's just a little glitchy. That's my only point.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, that kind of just speaks to how bad Temple's passing game had been for the past, I don't know, half decade until this season, that they're just a little bit better, and they've still got a lot of flaws.
Which really seems like you can say about everybody in the conference, except for maybe like UCF.
Yeah. And hell, maybe to an extent UC. I don't know. They've been pretty damn flawless this season offensively.
But like, you could also use the same like qualifiers. Like, they've played a bunch of terrible teams and put up really solid offensive numbers. I think the main thing is like Temple's defense is best in fewest points per opposition drive. The Bearcats have a top 10 offense in that measure because they've scored on pretty much everybody lately. So that's going to be really interesting to see how the offense functions on the road. Like, there's going to be a lot of pressure on Ritter, like his first true road start, not because UConn doesn't count.
Anyway. I mean, UConn counts as a win, so it should count, but yeah. I get what you're saying.
There have to be people that care in the stands for it to be a true road game.
So will Temple really count?
It will 3/4 count as a win, a true road win.
That's fair. Yeah, and like this defense is—it's exactly what Temple always is. They're extremely good again in terms of limiting big plays, and UC has feasted on those plays in a lot of their games this year. But the one part of this matchup that I kind of like for UC is. UC it's like average explosiveness, but they're very efficient. Like, they're really good at picking up 3, 4, 5 yards of play at a time and driving the length of the field if they have to. And that's really the only way you're going to be able to do it against Temple, because they just do not give up those chunk plays. They're extremely solid on the back end. Their coverages are incredibly complex because they basically do, like, they will have one coverage on half of the field and then a different coverage on the other half of the field and make it look kind of seamless for the quarterback. That's going to be a huge challenge for a young quarterback like Ritter. Now, everybody raves about his ability to analyze and dissect a defense, but this is going to be the first really big test of that part of his game.
Yeah, I mean, the one concern you have to think about is, like, the sacks allowed. Now, Temple, they're 14th in the country in sacks, with 20. But most of those came against Maryland and a Tulsa team that is one of the worst offensive lines in the country. I mean, outside of that, they had 2 against Nova, none against Buffalo, 2 against Boston College, 3 against East Carolina, and I'm not even including Navy because Navy probably threw the ball twice in that game. So, I mean, I'm definitely going to be concerned about that defense, but I feel like I'm more concerned about the defense stuffing Michael Warren up the middle, just because that's all they really have seemed to do with him, than getting Ridder in the backfield.
Yeah, and to that end, I think this is a, you know, we talked about last week how this is, the bye week is an opportunity to do some self-scouting and try to kind of incorporate some new concepts into the office. I think this is the game where you have to unleash Desmond Ridder as a runner. With designed runs, with, you know, called reads, all that kind of stuff that they haven't really been doing this year. Because Temple is, they are very, very tough in the box, and you need to kind of flip that numbers advantage they have, and the only way you can do that is by running the quarterback. That obviously puts him at risk, and he is not the biggest guy, but I think that is what they're going to have to do to have success, to have sustained success against this offense, or against this defense.
And that's really the key to the game, is like sustaining your offense, which hasn't been a problem for UC this year. Like, as you mentioned, they've been incredibly efficient, like throwing and running the ball. And it's going to be, like, I don't know, like, interesting is like the only word that pops in my head, because it's going to be a really interesting challenge to see how they do this against the best defense they've played by far. And like how they even perform on the defensive side of the ball against a team that's improved offensively. And like, we like know they have good coaches at Temple, and just seeing like how, what little things they come up with against like the Bearcat defense, I think is going to be something to really to watch. So we've seen like Tulane give UC like a little trouble, like, and they have good scheme, and so did Ohio. So it'd be interesting to see what Temple takes from that.
Yeah, and the difference between those two teams and Temple is Russo is not a threat to run. He really isn't. He's not a statue bearer, but he's not a guy who's going to, you know, take a busted play and get you 5 yards out of nothing. He's far more likely to go down on a sack in that situation than he is to kind of create something out of nothing. And that's what UC really is going to have to do in this game defensively. They're going to have to get Temple off schedule. If they just pick up, you know, average meaningful yardage on first and second down, they become a very difficult team to stop on third down, just because they can lean on that offensive line. There are thousands of tight ends and their running backs, and just kind of get the 2-3 yards that they need pretty much whenever they want. And that has really been the difference. Temple has kind of dominated this game in the last couple of years because they have had that physicality advantage at the point of attack on offense. They shouldn't have that this year. UC's defense is much better, but that still is a going concern, because UC really hasn't played an offense that has this sort of setup where that is kind of their end goal, is to get in those situations so they can just lean on their offensive line. So that's going to be a little bit different.
Yeah, and you got to think that kind of, that plays into UC's advantage, just out-muscling an opposing, you know, in the trenches. Because they've shown it this year. I mean, their front four can man up against the front five if they need to and have success. And if Marcus Freeman needs to dial up, you know, Brian Wright or Perry Young on a blitz, he's more than capable of doing it, and they'll get in there and you know, create some havoc. And that's a good point. I mean, if you're talking about a Temple team that is really reliant on getting those 3 to 4 yard gains on first and second down to set yourself up for a short third down conversion, I mean, that's just something that's going to play into UC's hands, right?
Yeah, I think so. And one huge advantage that UC has in this game is Cortez Broad. He has been one of the best, most efficient, most disruptive defensive tackles in the country this year. And I see no reason why that play can't, you know, why that level of play cannot continue into this game. You know, if you go back to the Boston College game for Temple, the player who killed their offense was a guy by the name of Zach Allen, who plays defensive end for the Eagles. He's a big dude. He's like 6'4", 6'3", something like that. Looks like he's 300, but he's probably a little bit less. But he kind of played like a hybrid tackle end And he just killed him. He had four tackles for loss alone in that game. And I don't see any reason why Cortez Bryant, as good as he has played this year, cannot have a similar impact in this game and contribute immensely to getting them off schedule.
Yeah, I'm with you there. Like, Broughton is the huge key. Like, the line getting pressure and, like, slowing down Temple's running game, like, with or without Armstead, I think is the big key to the game. Because if you can make them one-dimensional, like, I trust the secondary to make plays because they've made plays all season long. And I take my chances with a Temple quarterback throwing, like, 35 times.
Yeah, absolutely. And the biggest difference between this year's defense and last year's defense is just the amount of range that these safeties have. In Derek Forrest and James Wiggins, you have guys who can go sideline to sideline. They can cover the earth. That's how gifted they are physically. There is not going to be a lot of free plays over the top against those two. But to make that, you know, come to bear, you have to have a good pass rush. And that's as good as UC's defense has been this year, that is the one gripe I do have. They are not getting home to the quarterback on passing downs nearly enough. And they're very aggressive. They've been blitzing a ton. But those blitzes haven't got home. And I think, Chris, you brought that up a couple weeks ago, talking about how the one thing this defense hasn't done for all the talk about how much better they are, and they are, that's one aspect of the game where they're not quite as advanced as any of us would like them to be. They're just not getting enough pressure on the passer. And maybe the bye week has allowed them to kind of go back to the drawing board, come up with some new, you know, new personnel groupings, new stunts, and new ways to affect the quarterback, because they're going to have to do that down the stretch to keep winning.
Yeah, absolutely. That just goes back into your original point of, you know, getting Temple off schedule. I mean, Temple's an offense. They go through the running game, but they're still among sacks allowed per game. They're third in the conference, just a little over one per game. I mean, if you're going to get Temple off schedule and really get that chaos going in the backfield, it's got to start with the pass rush, and they've got to get like a third. If it's like a third and four, or a third and five, even like a second and eight or something like that, they've got to get them into. You got to get the quarterback down to the backfield. I mean, there's no other answer besides that. Because I mean, have you guys watched Temple's games this year? I don't know what else they do in the running game besides just try to pound Armstead all day long. Like, do they float him out on a flat? Do they try to get him on screens? Like,
no, he's not really a threat as a receiver. I think he only has three or four catches on the year. Right. What they do like to do is get some of the receivers involved in the running game with end-arounds, jet sweeps, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And they've been reasonably effective, but it's not something that they, you know...
Right.
It's not part of their bread and butter. It's not a concept that you're going to see on every single play.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there we go. I mean, yeah, just get them in the backfield and get them into second and third and longs.
Right, one of the receivers has 12 carries, which is... quite a bit for a receiver. And, like, to your point about Temple's offensive line, like, all season long, like, Russo's only been sacked four times. It's like, that's something that they're really cognizant of in their offense, is him getting the ball out of his hands quickly. So I think that does put, like, a little bit more pressure on, like, your linebackers and your secondary to make some plays in the pass game, and, like, your defensive line to try to get there and get him down and, like, disrupt his timing if they have a big-time timing offense. So this is, like, one of those types of games where it's, like, you can get Temple in third and long. I think it really ups your chances of winning dramatically. And vice versa, same with Temple, because I don't think either special teams unit has really shined this season.
No, I mean, they haven't been great, but neither is, you know, they're not dumpster fires like some of the special teams in this conference.
They've been a little... Temple, though, I mean, their kicking game is just way off. I mean, they've only made 3 of 7 field goals on the season. And, I mean, I went through this a little bit earlier this week. I mean, their red zone offense is just atrocious. Like second to last in conversion, something like 66%. Or I'm sorry, yeah, something like 60% of red zone conversions end up in points. 69%. Sorry. The others, I mean, out of the seven where they have converted, they've thrown two picks and missed three field goals, and two of those field goals were within the 10-yard line. Like their kicking game is god awful.
Yeah, by every.
I stand corrected. They're 118th in special teams S&P plus.
It's because of what Chris said. Their kicking game is unbelievably bad. It's the worst in the nation. By like every single like advanced metric, because their kickers are terrible, and that applies on their kickoffs too, where their kick coverage hasn't been that good. It's like the return game is fine, but it's like their kick game and like their kickoff game, it's really not good. I think that there's a big opportunity there too, like maybe for somebody to like break one, even though we haven't really seen that this season from the Bearcats kick return game.
All right, Alden, it's your turn. You got to do something now. Have to. You're not going to have many more opportunities.
Yeah. Yeah, not especially with all these rule changes coming through too. Yeah, I mean, I feel like for UC defensively, it's stop them between the 20s, which seems really strange. Because, I mean, they have, like, such a strong running game. You'd think that condensing them against your own goal line would be at your disadvantage. But it's almost like if you just get them off the field between the 20s, or I'm sorry, if you even allow them into the red zone, you should be fine, right? Like, by the numbers, which just seems kind of counterintuitive.
If you can get them to kick downs. Or, you know, Jeff Collins might just decide, you know what, fuck it. Today's the day we're doing all fourth down runs. Don't care. And he might have to do that.
Yeah.
This is just I think it's going to be a real challenge just to see where things end up. Because I think this is a winnable game, but also it's like the toughest game they've played. And it's a really, of course, it's like a losable game. Just going on the road, like as a conference underdog. Against a team like you seem like you haven't beaten in like 4 years.
Yeah, but these are the types of games where if your ambition is to challenge for a conference title, to go to a New Year's Six Bowl, to get to that level, this is a type of game where you have to win. And this is a really young team. They're going to have more opportunities like this, but this is the first one. So let's kind of like... It's a measuring stick game. Like, let's see where you are now. Because you're going to be better. Like, it's going to be better in the next couple of years. We all kind of agree with that. But, you know, let's see how far they are. Let's see how far they've come now. Like, let's see how far they've come in 9 months. Because this time last year, this game would have been a fucking bloodbath.
Yeah, and it's, you know, everyone's looking, you know, staring up at Central Florida in the conference, but I mean, if you want to have Aspen beating Central Florida and rising to that level yet again, I mean, you've got to take care of business against the Temple, against the South Florida, even, you know, teams that you've pretty much been staring up at for the last 2 years, and you know, everyone wants to focus on the Central Florida, and rightfully so. I mean, it's going to be a bloodbath, but I mean, it really just starts this Saturday, and it's going to be. I feel like this Saturday is going to be one of those really annoying, grindy, frustrating games. Like, I think the passing game should be fine, but it's just going to be like one of those every touchdown, every first down is just going to like take my heart out and just play ball with it for like 3 hours while they try to like inch out a couple of yards here and there. Like, I can see this game being like tied at like 7 at halftime or like 14 at halftime.
Oh, I'm expecting that because this is a really interesting game. We keep saying the word interesting for this game because it is objectively the most interesting game they've played just because there are so many different factors that are coming into this game. You know, preseason, nobody had expectations for this team, so nobody had expectations for the game at Temple, which kind of set up your closing run. But now, you know, 6-0 in the hunt for the conference and all this, and it matters so much more. And you have a whole lot of young players who have not really been in this environment before. And you know, Chris, you said you're not worried about the passing game. I'm kind of worried about the passing game because extremely complicated secondary to go against. They're going to have to be very diligent about how they read coverages and adjust the routes accordingly. You know, they have to be on the same page as Ritter. And generally, this kind of defense is a nightmare for younger receivers, and UC has nothing but younger receivers. So their ability to kind of adjust to, you know, on the fly to what this defense is going to show them is going to be huge.
And let's not, like, overlook the fact that this is, like, the first game they played against a team that has a winning record, like, in the entire season.
Yeah. Relevant point.
Like, there is, like, a bit of a bigger challenge than playing, like, Miami, who had lost their opener, or Ohio, who was 1-1, and Tulane was 2-3. It's, like, a team that's won four out of their last five games. And it looks like they're turning the tables. But, like, who really knows about Temple? It's, like, hard to trust some of their wins, too, when they beat, like, Tulsa and East Carolina and a really bad Navy team.
Yeah, and that's a good point. You know, Temple's kind of turnaround has come against the dregs of the AAC schedule for the most part. And the only average or above average team they've played in that stretch has been Boston College. And Boston College, it was a close game. They were in it. But Boston College was pretty much in control from about the second quarter on. Like, I've watched most of that game live. And the only time I felt like Temple was really in with the shot was probably first quarter into the second quarter. And then that kind of went away. Because even when, you know, they took the lead in the third and the fourth quarter, you never really knew that the stop was going to be coming. Because that game turned into a shootout where they had to get a stop. And uncharacteristically for Temple, I just didn't feel like that stop was coming.
And that was without A.J. Dillon, because he got hurt, the third quarter of that game. And Boston College was still able to close them out.
Yeah, A.J. Dillon ran himself injured is essentially what happened there.
The interesting thing about Temple is like that gigantic win against Maryland, who is like 4-2. But still, like 35-14 on the road at Maryland is nothing to like sneeze at, I guess, especially for a team in the AAC.
Well, two pick six will do that. I mean, and we haven't talked about this point. Temple's had four non-offensive touchdowns, and most of them have come in that Maryland game, and I think they had another one against Navy. My timing on those might be wrong, but I know that they've had the four non-offensive TDs, which is, you know, helpful.
And very Temple-like, it was like.
Yes, very Temple-like, because if you can't score with your offense, you know, you gotta get the defense involved. They gotta do everything.
Yeah. It's a pain in the ass. Yeah, and I'm going to probably put this one at, like, 24-21 Cincy. I know Temple's favored by, like, a field goal in this game. And I can't remember if it's the NFL or college or both that automatically gives 3 points to the home team.
It's both.
Okay. Especially if Armstead's out. I think UC wins this by, like, a field goal or a touchdown. But, like, in the 20s.
Yeah, and that's another thing that's going to be that we have to watch is how, because Temple knows what Armstead's status is going to be, whether or not he can go the full load, whether or not he can play, but can only play, you know, he has a snap limit, he can only play so many times. And knowing that gives them the opportunity to game plan to that. So, you know, we could see a completely different style of Temple offense than we've seen most of this year. That would be uncharacteristic for Jeff Collins, who just who doesn't have the reputation for being the kind of guy who would go for, like, would sign off on that kind of strategy. But it's something that they could do, and it's something we definitely have to watch, because, you know, Armstead really is the engine for that team on offense. And Russo is a good young quarterback. He's only a sophomore. He's going to get better. But whether or not he's able to carry the load offensively on his own is going to be something that we're going to have to keep an eye on, because he might have to.
Yeah, definitely. And, like, I think that's really where this game is going to be won or lost, is, like, on his right arm. And on the right arm of Desmond Ridder. Like, whatever quarterback makes the plays, like, their team's going to win. You could say that about almost any game, but I think in this one, where both defenses have played at a high level pretty much the entire season, like, Temple just gave up 14 passing yards against Navy, which, granted, is Navy, but still, like, 14 yards on, like, 3 of 14 passing. And Ritter's going to have to make, like, some big plays in the passing game against a secondary that can, like, get pick sixes and a defense that throws different looks at you. I do think the Bearcats are going to win, though. I'm going to go 21-20.
Oof.
I think it's going to be a tight game.
I really believe the Bearcats are going to win this. And, you know, rose-colored glasses, all that. And I don't know how much this is my heart or my head, but my head definitely wants my heart to be happy. And my heart would be thrilled with a win. But, like, I really just think this is going to be one of those, like, these games have not been fun to watch the last couple of years, and not just because Temple just physically dominated at the line of scrimmage for 4 years. The style of football has not been enjoyable, and I think this is going to be a bit of a slog.
Oh, I think it's going to be a lot of a slog. It's going to be field position and turnovers are really going to decide this one. Like, more so than these other games, where you could drive down on a lot of their other opponents. And so the field position game really didn't matter a ton. Like, in this one, it matters, because if you get pinned back deep, and, like, their offense is always starting at the 40, it's going to be a long day. And, like, that seems like exactly what the Temple game was last year, where they couldn't finish drives, and Temple just ground them into dust.
Yeah, but we have the Australian punter, so...
Yeah, and it's pretty awesome. And yeah, I think you guys make a good point. It's gonna be tight, and it's gonna pretty much come down to who makes the least amount of giant fuck ups. You can throw a pick here or there, but, like, Matt, to your point, I mean, they've had four pick sixes on the season. I mean, that's no accident. I mean, they're creating those opportunities. It's one of those situations where you kind of have to treat it sort of like the second half of that Ohio game. You don't have to play, like, perfect ball, but you have to just play mistake-free, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, you have to play within yourself in this game. You can't go 4 days, especially downfield in the passing game. Like, this is going to be a Deguara-heavy game in the flats, just because that's what Temple gives you. So, you know, he's going to get targeted 10 times, probably. And as long as he catches it and gets his 4 or 5 yards, positive play, you kind of wash your hands and say, that's good, let's keep doing more of those. But it's just going to, like, it's such a difficult thing for an offense to play against this defense with the way they're constructed, and doubly so with the young quarterback and an extremely young receiver core.
I was going to say a fun game. I don't know how fun it will be to actually watch most of it.
No, it's going to be a terrible game. It's going to be it's going to be such eye cancer.
Hopefully the result will be better than it has been. Hey, do you have anything else to add about this game, Matt and Chris?
Yeah, I think Khalil Lewis, he had kind of a breakout in the last game. I think he's got an opportunity to have another strong showing against Temple just because he is the only guy who has seen this defense before. That will give him some advantage in terms of finding spots.
Yeah, Lewis had 84 yards last season against Temple. But UC's leading rusher in the game last year was Hayden Moore, who had 75 rushing yards.
Oh, God.
If that happens again, I think UC will probably be on the wrong side of the scoreboard in this one.
Yeah, they'll be down by like 5 touchdowns.
So UC last year against Temple did run for 184 yards, which I think is like a, like maybe Mike Warren could have a big game. With how big a part of the offense he is, he's pretty much got to have like a solid game at least for them to win.
Yeah, like I anticipate him having 100 yards. I just anticipate him also needing 35 carries to get to 100.
And it seems like they will give him 35 carries if necessary.
We should also dust off Thomas the Tank. I think he would help in this game just because he's really good at running straight at people and running them over.
Yeah. And he's young. I mean, he's got years to burn. I mean, he should be fine, just taking a few lumps and then recovering slowly over time.
I'm not sure he...
That's why you play true freshman, right? For cannon fodder?
Unless you're really bad, that's a bad idea.
Okay.
No, but I like it. I think he has, you know, like he has 100% health at all times because he just runs dudes over.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to get injured when you're the largest person on the field half the time.
And the fastest, which isn't fair.
Yeah, I don't think humans are supposed to be built at 230, 6'3" or 6'2" and able to run like a 4.5 or 6.40. I don't think that was in the plans.
No, I just like that Fickell has really, you know, gone the whole hog and embraced Nick Saban's philosophy on giant-ass running backs.
Yeah.
Which are the most terrifying running backs.
It's like, yeah, it's like he was sitting in his office one day and he's like, you'll be really cool if I had a defensive end who could play running back. That'd be awesome.
And I had 5 of them.
Minion, go find me 5 of these.
And I, not to kind of veer off, but I've actually really appreciated that about his recruiting recently. Like, between the 2017 and 2018 classes, he stockpiled running backs. And my initial concern was, how the hell are you going to find playing time for all these guys between McClelland and Thomas? And, you know, you already have Warren and Doakes on the roster, and then you're bringing in Ryan Montgomery as well. And, goddamn, if they haven't found a perfect situation to get most of them reps. I mean, Doakes going down is a big part of that, but I mean, yeah, it's definitely that Ohio State philosophy of just basically, you know, rotating in as many running backs as you possibly can and not really worrying about playing time.
And that does require like a big buy-in on your running backs, especially the guys who aren't the main guys getting carries. So you always have to be ready for that opportunity. And you can see it like on other teams, like when the guy's like not happy he's the starter, like your running back production goes off a cliff when your main guy's out. It's like everybody's bought in and like they've had a really solid running game all season long. And getting people to buy in, I think, is half the struggle in college football.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that was a big, not a problem last year, but it, you know, kind of a source of friction, is going from a coach who is extremely hands-off to someone who, you know, is in the building and is there all the time and is really kind of invested in not only his success, but your success as well. And that's a huge 180. And it's not surprising that some people just didn't take to it.
And, yeah, I think that's a good point. We can pivot away from there to the rest of the league real quick. Last week, didn't see like a bevy of action. They did see a couple of really tight games from the Florida teams, where South Florida needed a fourth quarter comeback. Like in the last, like, well, like 10 minutes, they scored three times on their last three drives to beat Tulsa 25-24.
South Florida should be 3-3. They are the weakest top 25 team I've ever seen.
Hey, you don't end games after three quarters. And luckily for them, they play that fourth.
I have, like, if we're looking down the next six games on the schedule, I have, like, in terms of, like, being concerned about an opponent, South Florida is, like, neck and neck with Navy for me. And that's after Central Florida and Temple. Like, South Florida, I just do not have any concern about South Florida, especially when we're getting them at home.
The home thing is different, but like I get it. Like, based on performance, I get it. I'm right there with you. But based on ceiling and ability to, like, jump up and bite somebody in the ass, South Florida's top of that list. Because if they ever put it all together, it will be a sight to behold. They've not come close to doing that this year. But it's there. Like, that, we all know what the sum of that would be, and it would be very good. But they have not approached that all year. So I get what you're saying, but, you know, the ceiling is a lot higher.
No, I get it. And it's like, you know, are you going to get the South Florida that just kind of middles around for three quarters? Or are you going to get the one that actually reaches its potential? I get that. As of now, I just, they're just like such a non-priority for me. Anywho, not to belabor that point.
Which is odd, because, like, their computer numbers, like, all, like, fine. And just, like, their on-field results have just been, like, really, like, wishy-washy. Because, like, as you guys said, they play three quarters. Like, and it's really strange to watch. It's like when they turned it on. Like, they turned it on, like, late against Tulsa. And, like, Tulsa didn't have, like, really a chance. And, like, they panicked down the stretch and, like, lost the game. But, like, yeah, even against, like, Carolina,
they got super conservative. Which is, like, history tells us one thing in football. If you're holding on to a lead and you stop playing the way that got the lead, you're going to lose. It's not that hard. But people do it every week. I don't get it.
Yeah, I think that's, like, the big problem with Tulsa this season as a whole. Is, like, they just haven't finished, like, any of their games.
They're basically the opposite of USF because they play the first three really well and then just mail the fourth.
Exactly right.
It's like, hey guys, we're good, right? We won this. Cool. We're gonna go get on the bus. Oh, y'all are still playing? Oh, that's definitely what happened against Texas. Like, they got on the bus after the third quarter. Like, they pulled a full Lee Corso. It was like, all right, we did what we came here to do. Let's go.
Yeah, 1-5 with 2-1 possession losses. They're really choke team. But just blow by Houston, East Carolina. Houston blew them out at 42-20. Ed Oliver had a monster game. It's the game of the week, game of the year in the conference was UCF 31, Memphis 30. A giant second half from the UCF team where they shut Memphis out and complete like a big comeback. Like really relying on their defense, which I thought was surprising. I mean, you couldn't watch the first half of this game and, like, buy into their defense. But the second half, they really bottled Memphis up to a surprising degree.
Yeah, and they were... the mindset helped.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say. Yeah, they were playing in a hurricane. Go ahead.
Yeah, Memphis is really good offensively, but they're so boomer bust. It's like, when it's booming, it is booming. Like, they're averaging 15 yards a carry, and every pass is 10 yards. But when that dries up, and it did against UCF in the monsoon, pun intended, they just have no, like, they don't have backup plans.
Yeah, I mean, Darrell Henderson had a great game. He was great, but, I mean, like, if you can't rely on, you know, the one aspect of an offense to carry your team. Go ahead.
Well, if your entire offense is, you know what, let's get a 70-yard run. and a 50-yard pass. That's not an offense. That's not sustainable. And it wasn't. And they lost.
He only had 30 yards the second half. And it's like pretty much summed up their offense.
Yeah, and Memphis' defense definitely came to play as Memphis in the second half. That also had something to do with this.
But Henderson, he's just so electric. Like, when he gets, like, in the open field, it's like, oh my god. Like, how do you stop him?
Praying hands emoji?
Yeah, pretty much.
And it's like another monster game from Mackenzie Milton, who is kind of good.
He probably won't go, but he probably should go to New York for the Heisman. I mean, like, he doesn't have a chance in hell at winning, but he's been, you know, it's Tua or Haskins, probably Tua, just because what he's doing is otherworldly. But, you know, McKenzie should get in an invite at some point in his career. If it's not this year, next year, because he's just been so good for so long already.
Well, he's got a great chance to put up numbers this week because they play East Carolina and UCF is somehow... Ooh. So UCF is only a 21-point favorite, which I find a little bit odd because the game is against East Carolina.
Yeah, but if he plays anything like he did against South Carolina State, you know, another game where another opponent that they drubbed, but he had an awful performance, I'd be a little concerned. I think, like Scott, you and I have been talking about this, like, most of the year. Like, ECU is bad, but I feel like they have a little bit of feistiness to kind of come up and bite you sometimes. Like, well, I don't think they're going to do it against Central Florida, but, like, they're just such a... They're a bad team, top to bottom, but they're just feisty enough to, like, catch us, standing the wrong way. Go ahead.
Absolutely right. They are a bad team because their offense is dreadful, but their defense is pretty good, and they are very active. They lead the conference in tackles for loss and sacks, and they have a chance to cause a lot of, you know, to get in Mackenzie Milton's face and get him off schedule and get him off his favorite launch points. And that's kind of the key with him because, as we know, he is a shorter quarterback. So if you can get him off the spot where he wants to throw, where he's going to have that window, it kind of gives you a little bit more of a chance to stop him. They're not going to shut him down just because there's too many weapons. They're too well schemed. Their offensive line is too good. You're never going to shut him down. But they can make life difficult for them. And they kind of have a little bit of a blueprint for how you go against this kind of offense because you got to dominate at the front and you got to get, you know, big negative plays to get them off schedule on offense.
But on the other side, like, they just lost by 22 points at home to Houston last week, and Central Florida is better than Houston.
Fair point.
The last 2 weeks, the post-game win expectancy for East Carolina is a combined 1%.
Nice.
Are we sure that's not a glitch? Like some sort of math issue?
No, because Temple beat the holy hell out of them.
And then Houston. That is a brutal stretch to go Houston Temple, right after Temple hit the good switch, and then UCF. Yeah, that's tough.
Oh, do you know who they play after that? After their
South Florida?
No, they play Memphis.
No, East Carolina's schedule is the hardest I've ever seen of any team on the planet.
They call the good teams from the West, the two of them.
Oh, yeah. And
look at East Carolina's schedule against, like, an average SEC team, and an SEC team would look at that and be like, oh shit. I don't want any of that. Like, holy crap. Like, they had their Virginia Tech game at Virginia Tech, replaced with at NC State at the end of the season. They've got Cincy, Memphis, South Florida, Central Florida, Houston, Temple. Like, my God.
East Carolina plays right now 6 games against the S&P Top 50. That's quite a bit for this league. I don't think they're going to make the bowl game.
No. No, what? I don't think they are.
Is that a question?
You know, At least they're not last in S&P Plus.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say they're not going to make a bowl game. Okay.
This was the bold prediction part of the podcast.
That limb was the size of a boulevard.
You know what? God help them. You know, East Carolina is terrible, but someone has to fall on their sword, and I'm happy that East Carolina is doing that for everybody else.
So is the next team that we're going to talk about is UConn, as they travel to South Florida. South Florida, 34-point favorite, with the over-under of 69 in this game, which is
nice,
and quite a bit of points. But I believe in South Florida that they're going to destroy Connecticut.
If the Bulls do not beat the fucking doors off UConn, there's some problems. Because UConn is really bad, especially on defense. They are the worst defense in the history of defense. And I'm only slightly exaggerating.
Yeah, Jordan Cronkite is going to probably run for like 250 yards in this game, and South Florida is going to win by 3.
Fun fact about UConn is that their turnover margin is minus 11, which is somehow not last in the nation.
I did enjoy that fact. That was a very good fun fact. Because anytime when you disparage UConn and make them feel bad about themselves, is always fun.
Yeah, it's really hard to win a football game when you start minus 2 in turnover margin before you win football. That's kind of difficult. Makes it a little tougher.
Stats say that it is hard.
Yeah. And the stats also say the most interesting game of the week is probably Missouri and Memphis. Because I've never seen an over-under over 70 this year. And that one's at 74. And that's accurate. I'm going the over.
Oh, yeah, same here. The no defense bowl, which should make it pretty exciting. Like, is there a chance that Memphis doesn't make a bowl game?
Yes. It's not a good chance because there's a lot of bad teams at the bottom of the West, but there's a chance.
Okay, I looked at the rest of their schedule. There's no chance they don't make a bowl game.
Yeah, I was kind of thinking the same thing, Scott, and like took a peek at their schedule, saw ECU and SMU, and then just penciled them right into a bowl game there.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting year for Memphis because the numbers love them, but this has to be considered a disappointing year for them.
Especially if they lose this game. And they go, we'll just say 8-4. Like, I think that would be a pretty big letdown. Like, that would get got Tony Levine fired at Houston a couple years ago. And I don't think it will get, like, Norvell fired. But it's the type of thing to, like, make people upset since they were, like, a pretty big heavy favorite to win the division, at the very least.
No, everyone logically took them to win the division, which makes total sense. I mean, they had one of the best offenses coming back in the entire conference, if not the country. And just no one realized just how complete dog shit that defense was.
No, I think everybody knew. They just thought the offense would be... They thought the offense would be good enough to overcome it, and it hasn't been. And the offense is good. The offense is fine. There's nothing wrong with the offense. But for whatever reason, they just have had their, their breakdown plays come at the worst possible moment for this team.
Yeah, like their finishing drives, they're 12th in the nation, like offensively, then 115th in the nation defensively, which is a combo for a 74-point over-under.
That's how you lose to Navy in a game where you dominate every phase. It is by not scoring touchdowns when you should score touchdowns. And allowing them when you shouldn't. That's a great recipe for losing.
Speaking of Navy, they go to Houston. Houston's only a 12-point favorite. I think Houston should be like at least 14 14-point favorite. So I think they're going to blow out Navy. Over under this game is 60 somehow.
No, that's right. Like, Houston has the best defensive player in the country. I firmly believe that. But they also have one of the glitchiest and most error-prone defenses in the country. And, like, I think their defensive S&P is 60th. Yeah, 60th. And a team that has Ed Oliver dominating at that position should be much, much better than that. But, like, his supporting cast is not – it has not been there this year.
But I just don't think Navy's going to score on them. I don't buy Navy's offense being that good either.
Yeah, I mean, Houston still gets an inordinate amount of, you know, chunk plays in terms of defensively, so they get a lot of tackles for loss. Not so much sacks against Navy, but they'll get them off schedule, and that's kind of where Navy goes to die.
And Ed Oliver had a monster game against Navy last year when Houston went and beat him. And he came off each game last week. So he's going to get that, like, little Heisman buzz when he puts up another, like, monster game on them.
He should, but he won't. They're just not good. Like, they're just not good enough. Houston isn't. And I don't know why. The cumulative effect, they should be better than they are. But I don't know. It's just not coming together for them. Because the offense is not the problem, and I thought that was going to be the issue coming into the year. But it hasn't been.
Yeah, they have a game at South Florida, or at home against South Florida next week. It's going to be a real, like, line in the sand game for both of those teams. Considering Houston doesn't trip and fall and lose at Navy. Rounding out the league, Tulane goes to SMU. Tulane's a 7-point favorite. Should Tulane ever be that big a favorite?
Have you seen SMU's defense?
That's tough to say. I mean, when you're playing SMU at home, yeah, you're going to be a touchdown favorite.
Yeah, the thing that SMU doesn't really do good on defense, they don't do anything good, but what they really don't do good at is stopping the run. I can see that being a problem in this game.
Fair enough. The final game of the week is Arkansas and Tulsa, which DC doesn't play Tulsa, and Tulsa's not going to make the title game. So who really cares?
They got another chance to win three quarters and then leave the bus at the start of the fourth, which they'll probably do because Arkansas is really bad. And in year, I don't even think it's a year zero. I think it's like
negative one.
Minus one. Yeah. Because shockingly enough, Brett Bielema did not recruit the athletes you need to run the team. So that's a problem.
That's a pretty big problem, to say the least. Let's switch gears completely before we get out of here. The AAC put out their preseason basketball predictions with surprise conference favorite, Central Florida. 6 first-place votes. They barely nudge out UC 114-107. Bearcats come up second, Houston third, Memphis fourth. All four of those teams get first place votes. Yeah, BJ Taylor, UCF guard, extraordinaire, preseason player of the year. Did this surprise you guys at all?
Yes and no. So I feel like a lot of voters are voting UCF first, because they have the least amount of major turnover of any of the major contenders in the conference. Like, UC lost a bunch of players. Houston lost Rob Gray. And UCF still has BJ Taylor and Taco Fall. On the other hand, I'm kind of like...
On the other hand, they haven't won shit.
Exactly. Like, I get it. BJ Taylor was out for a lot of last season. But they still had Taco Fall. They still had one of the best defenses in the country, and they did nothing with it. Like, I guess they assume that BJ Taylor back, it's going to make a big difference, which it might, but you're assuming that Cincinnati all of a sudden doesn't know how to win championships, and Houston's going to take a major drop off, and you know, Wichita State eighth surprises the hell out of me of all of that. I don't know. I'm not sure where the voters' heads are at here.
Well, Taco Fall also did play half the season last year. So, like, their two best players missed almost the entire season when you combine them. So, like, I could see, like, some of the optimism for UCF, but I don't know. That just seems a bit too extreme. And as you mentioned, Wichita State, number eight, like, they did lose, like, a ton, but like, this is the AAC, not, like, the SEC or the ACC, where, like, every team is loaded. It's like, do you really think that Temple is going to be better than them or UConn? Like, UConn should be better,
Temple and the Fighting Fran Dunphys are going to be really fired up to go because this is Fran's last year. Those look like it's been his last year for, like, 7 years. I'm not talking like he hasn't looked like he's retired. I'm just saying it looks like he's retired. Just his general continence screams retired man.
I don't know, like, them in Memphis, I'm like, are we really going to ride on the Penny Hardaway train that hard this season in year one? Like, he hasn't coached a single game yet, and he's never coached a collegiate basketball game in his life. Like, and you put Memphis fourth ahead of Danny Hurley's UConn team, which, like, the only thing holding back UConn over the last couple of years has been good coaching, and holy shit, you hired one of the best mid-major coaches in the country. I don't get some of those. The rankings are just all over the place for me.
I think you could make the argument against UConn, like, just with, like, their general depth. It's like, they have a great player in Adams. Well, I was surprised wasn't the preseason player of the year. And, like, then, like, really nothing else. Like, you think they would be coached a lot better than they were last year, which was their major downfall.
Yeah.
You mean you assume that they would be coached?
They would have a coach on the sideline. I just, like, for me, I'm like, okay, Central Florida, I think, is a top three team. I think that's fair. But I would have UC, Houston, USF. Then I would have, I don't know, like, SMU, Wichita State, and then UConn and UConn, Memphis, Temple. That's where I would put it.
Yeah, SMU and Wichita State being down there is surprising. And, like, I get, like, this is a much tougher league than Wichita is used to. And, like, if this was still the Valley and Wichita State was bringing back this group of players, you just pencil them in at first just because you trust the infrastructure. But this is year two in a new league, and there is a ton of turnover with their top guys. So it's difficult to kind of trust the infrastructure that it will work at this level. I trust Greg Marshall. I think they'll be fine. I think they're going to be, I don't know if they're going to make the tournament, but they're going to be flirting with it, I think, at the end. I mean, if they actually end up finishing eighth in this league, it will be a shocking turn of events.
I just think it's odd that, like, you look at SMU last year, and kind of, Scott, to your point earlier, you know, UCF was without BJ Taylor and Taco Fall for a lot of the season. SMU won a ton of games, and they played, like, five total players most of the season. Like they had zero depth last year, and it really proved how strong of a coach Tim Jankovich is. Yeah, I mean, he coached the hell out of that team last season with zero depth, and they put him at seventh. Like, I don't get that. Like, you're giving UCF the benefit of the doubt of not of losing players last season, but you're not giving SMU the same benefit of the doubt. Like, that just seems weird for me. And I'm going to get off of my SMU soapbox because I don't really want to. I'm not really going to, you know, go die in a battlefield for SMU, but still.
I guess the voters' big knock against them would have to be how they played when Shig Milton got hurt last year, which was, like, not great.
And well, yeah, but Shake wasn't the only injury they had. Jerry Foster was out for half the year, too. Yeah, and he's probably going to be their guy coming back.
Yeah, I'm just using that as a guess, since he's gone off into the pros, like, as to why they got voted under Temple. Like, I find some of this really interesting.
Yeah, but Temple's really got the perfect team for this league this year because, like, I mean, the first team all league shows it. There is not a post to be seen anywhere. Like, there are no big guys in this league. It is all guards. So yeah. And Temple has two of the most versatile guys in, you know, Shiz Alston and Quentin Rose. I can see them having a bounce back year and maybe flirting with, you know, the tournament.
Yeah, I think if they can navigate their non-conference well enough, they could end up in the tournament. So they should be able to feast on the back half of this league. But to your point about the bigs, all guards on the all-conference teams except for Taco Fall and Marcus McDuffie, the only two non-guards on the entire team.
Yeah, it's a guard-heavy league.
And it seems like everybody has one guard. And, like, the rest of their team is almost a mystery.
It's the Spider-Man rule. Everybody gets one.
It's the only team with, like, what, multiple selections is UCF. Of all teams, they have two all-conference players. And I guess SMU does as well, because Jamal McMurray and Jerry Foster are both on the second team.
So, remember when Jamal McMurray was at USF? That was fun.
No, I don't, actually.
That's where he transferred from.
Okay.
So, rare interleague transfer, but, you know, USF, sitting there in 12th. It's not getting better.
Yeah.
Only 18.
And that's actually kind of a good point. Like, do you think, like, ECU and USF have been just dragging this league down for, what, 2-3 years now? Like, is there a situation where they finally climb their way out of, like, the 300-plus RPI range?
I mean, there's a way to do it. Tulane did. And Tulane, you know, hired a great basketball mind at the tail end of his career, let's be frank. And it's kind of elevated them. Like, I would be shocked to see Tulane down in the 300s again, but I fully expect to see ECU and USF. And ECU is different. There is not – they do not have the resources nor the institutional support to ever be better than what they are. But USF has the resources.
Yeah.
They should be better than
that. New arena, yeah.
But they can't seem to get it together and haven't been able to get it together for – how long have they been playing basketball? 40 years? They made one tournament.
I think you could make the argument. Like, they both made, I guess, solid hires. I'm not sure about the Joe Giulia, like, going back to East Carolina thing. Like, but Brian Gregory is, like, an all-right coach. Like, he did well at Dayton when they were in the A-10. Like, I don't think he's, like, a prime-time coach. But, like, they should be better. USF, like, they shouldn't go like 10 and like 25 again.
Yeah, I mean, I think USF should be, they should be like that middle of the pack team, just with their location, their resources. For me, I don't know how ECU climbs out of the hole. Like, their whole athletic department is a mess. They're definitely a basketball-first school, or I'm sorry, a football-first school, and you're like the, what, like 8th, 9th, or 10th best, you know, basketball school in your state, and you're in the middle of nowhere.
Like, yeah, and like ECU's whole philosophy is really interesting to me, because like they've kind of taken a similar approach to what Appalachian State has done, where in a state that is basketball mad, they are the football schools, right? So that's kind of how they've built their brand. But to build their brand, they've neglected the other revenue sports. And I don't see how you overcome that. Because this is not a decision that happened in the last, you know, 3 or 4 years. Like, ECU made that decision in, like, the 70s. Because that's when they first started to really invest in their football program and build that stadium and kind of get that going. And it's worked spectacularly well. That's the only reason they're in this league. But they got to bring the basketball around. They got to get it to where, at the, like, their floor should be competitive, right? And they're not. They're not competitive. And it's the same thing with the USF. They are, their floor should be, we are a competitive team in a tough out. With the resources they have, with the money, the recruiting base, all that. That's where their floor should be. And that floor is like a KenPom 250, right?
Yeah.
But they've been in the 300s for 5 years in a row, six years in a row. It's bad. And I don't see a way to stop it. Other than a long-term kind of institutional change in direction to make that a priority.
It's like something like that. You just have to go out of the box and try different things. Because like doing it the traditional way, like, it clearly has not worked. It's like you have to try to hit, like, the home run hires. Or, like, the grand slam hires.
Like, well, and that's the thing, though. Like, they tried to go out of the box with Antigua, right? Like, that's a former Harlem Globetrotter. That's going to be your coach. Cool. Great story. Everybody went to Tampa because Tampa's nice and they want to go to warmer weather for their off-season writing, right? But then the season started, and it turns out, oh, yeah, he doesn't know how to coach or develop players or any of the things that involved with succeeding at a program of this level. So, you know, you got to take another swing.
He couldn't keep players on his own roster from staying year after year. Like, well, you can't even do that.
That was an issue.
But I wouldn't have called him like an out-of-the-box grand slam hire, though. Like, just hiring a Kentucky assistant who was good at recruiting. Like, I don't, that one didn't win me over as much, like, when they hired him. And it, like, turned out to be a massive mistake.
Well, yeah, that's, like, USF's problem is not talent. Not really. I mean, like, they can get, there is plenty of good basketball being played in Florida. There's plenty of good basketball being played in just Tampa. They don't really need to get the ace recruiter. They don't really need to go that route. They just need to have an infrastructure, some infrastructure, any sort of structure to their program, because right now it's just, well, you know, roll the balls out, see what happens. Hopefully it'll be fine. It's not.
And like, for the longest time, Stan Heath kind of built a culture down there. Like, we're talking about, like, I mean, building a culture of, you know, to your point, Matt, they were a tough out for a while. Like, how many 45, 46 games did we see UC play against South Florida? Like, we'd always pencil that into the schedule and be like, oh, shit, here's going to be a grinder that's going to just, we want to tear our eyes out by the end of it. And they had that for a while with Stan Heath, and they just never really did what, like, Mick Cronin did, was, you know, evolve the program as you start to bring in better talent to fit the style that matches the talent. And then it just kind of started a middle, and then just went off a cliff, and his Dan Heath got fired.
They skipped a step is what they did. They went from, so they had, like, you know, you go from A to B to C, right? They got to A with Dan Heath. And then his relationships with people soured, stuff went bad, blah, 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 whatever. The circumstances are irrelevant. So rather than going from A to B and getting another coach who fits that mold, coaches in the same way, can get these players to perform at the same level, has just a general focus for the game that's very similar to the outgoing person, they go from A to, like, C, and it's like, all right, now we're going to start recruiting top-line athletes, and, well, what are you going to do with them? We're going to play basketball. No, but what are you going to do with them? And he didn't have an answer. And everybody's like, this is a shit show. I'm leaving.
Yeah, definitely. I think you could, like, say, like, they've been by far the most disappointing team since the AAC was formed. It's like, of course, like, they took, like, their lumps in the Big East. But, like, you think that, like, they would have, like,
no, but you go from the Big East to this league and you get worse.
Yeah. Oh, I know. Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah, they're worse than they were in the Big East.
Yeah, you think, like, they would have figured out some way to, like, bridge the gap instead of just continuing to be bad. They won 12 games, Stan Heath, last year, and they have not won 12 games since then. But as a high, they've won more than 12 games total.
It's like they're swimming with rocks in their pockets, and then, you know, that's playing in the Big East, right? You're a little way down, but you can kind of make it do. And then they go to an easier league and just decide, you know what? We're going to put boulders in our pockets. It's going to be awesome. And they proceeded to sink to the bottom of the pool and drown.
it's kind of sad when, like, Seth Greenberg was, like, by far their most interesting coach in, like, the last, like, 20 years.
Yeah, it's not been a great run for USF. Maybe one day they'll get it together.
Can bring back B.B. Walden.
I mean, to your guys' point, they're right there. Like, it's not lack of resources. It's not a location issue. It's just finding a guy who is a decent coach, which seems like the pretty easy to do. Like, that's something you shouldn't fuck up if you're an athletic director. Like, you should be able to just find a guy who has some history of success coaching at a lower level and pay him enough money to get him over there.
Well, I think even more than that, to Matt's point earlier, is like you have to change that whole culture about basketball. Like you have to get people to look at it like it's more than something that you do in the winter. It's like, oh, you watch the basketball games. Like, because every other team in that state has won. Except for, I guess, like, even like UCF has made the tournament before, I think. But, like, there's really no excuse they should be so bad. When, like, Florida Gulf Coast is, like, making multiple tournaments.
Yeah, and Florida Gulf Coast is in a Tampa suburb, essentially. I don't know, maybe hire that guy. And, like, I know the original guys at USC.
That's what East Carolina did. Again.
Wait. Oh, that's right. He was there. I forgot. He's been around a long time.
So what happens like when you become like a coach at like before you're 30? It's like he seems like he's been a coach for like 75 years and he's like 50. Okay. Is there anything else you guys want to get to before we wrap this podcast up?
No, I'm good. Bearcats.